Welcome back to WordBalloon.com, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. Today, a talk with Dan DiDio, the executive editor of DC Comics. DiDio's tenure at the top of DC has been both a time of change and returning to the status quo, getting concepts and characters back to basics, like Supergirl, Green Lantern, and Batman, to killing older characters and rebooting the concepts as new properties. There have been big changes in the DCU thanks to events like Identity Crisis, Infinite Crisis, and the weekly series 52. Fan reactions, both positive and negative, have resulted in one clear direction. People are buying the books, interested to see what happens next in the DC Universe. While the huge changes in the DC status quo have angered a lot of fans, one thing can't be denied. DiDio has fulfilled his promise to readers. The monthly books matter and deliver in their shocking plot developments. Waiting for the trade has gotten a lot harder when we hear what might happen next. We'll take a look at some of the editorial decisions Dan has made and his enthusiastic look ahead for DC in 2007. But first, our conversation begins with a look at Dan's television career and the steps that led to DC. I'm curious about your background in terms of running a writer's room. Is it fair to say that's what you were doing at ABC when you were running daytime television in a certain respect?
When I was doing two different things. Daytime television, I was doing publicity.
Okay.
So what I would do then is I was handling the publicity for three of the New York-based soap operas at the time, which is All My Children, One Life to Live, and Loving, which was the third show coming out of New York at that time.
Okay.
That's what I was working on to start with. And then what happened is that I moved out to Los Angeles, and I actually was running the day-to-day operations for the ABC Saturday morning schedule.
Oh, okay.
So it wasn't much as running the writer's room as it was running the schedule, and I was a program exec on a number of the shows that were taking place at the time.
How does that equate with what you do currently at DC?
Well, I was always a longtime comic fan.
Okay.
You know, I've been reading comics since I was 12 years old, so I've been reading for a long number of years. And even though I worked in television for about 26 years, I always found a way to work comics into my business, comics into my job. And, you know, whether it was, you know, finding a couple of comic professionals that were soap opera fans and giving them tours. There was even a day that I had worked out a deal between All My Children and Valiant Comics, and we had one of our soap stars appear in The Second Life of Dr. Mirage. So I always found ways to work out comics and get involved in it. And one of the things I learned working in the soap opera side was, you know, the continuous storytelling. And I saw a lot of similarities between soaps and comic books in the sense that we're telling continuous fiction with the same characters. You know, the one thing daytime has to deal with is the fact that they never go into reruns. So you're constantly having to come up with new stories, constantly having to come up with new ways, new attitudes, new directions for your characters, new mixes, new problems, new dangers, new romances, new everything, because that's the way the shows work. And you have an extremely loyal fan base in soaps as you do in comics. So I saw how the fiction was being told in the soap operas, and I've always stored it away because I always found it to be extremely fascinating how they used to plan out stories 8 months in advance, a year in advance, but also were able to make changes based upon what characters were breaking out and what actors were really the ones garnering the most attention. Then I moved into Saturday morning, and by working in the cartoons, got a real chance of being able to craft episodic stories, which is where I was working with a number of series. I'd worked on things like a show called Reboot, Tales from the Crypt Keeper, mm-hmm. animated Free Willy, Dumb and Dumber. So I got a chance to really get more of a structured form of storytelling. And I would look at a half-hour show similar to working, a 22-page comic book in some ways.
Sure. Was your work in animation, was that tied to your work at Mainframe as well?
Well, it's the way it worked out is that I was executive director of ABC Saturday morning,
mm-hmm.
And then Disney bought ABC, and they were basically closing down our department.
Right.
I had the job of canceling Reboot at the time, and they got revenge, and then they hired me to be the story editor of the next season when they received financing to just actually produce the show in Canada to start with. And that started my relationship with Mainframe. So I wound up a story editor for Mainframe, and then actually I wound up opening their LA offices, handling the development, and then the marketing of product, and then some of the sales of the product as well.
I wonder before we leave television, isn't it crazy? I mean, because I imagine you're only a few years older than me, that Saturday mornings used to be the destination for all kids and really comic book tie-ins and stuff.
Well, it's amazing for me because I saw the transition taking place. I was there when Nickelodeon exploded.
Right.
And, you know, Saturday morning, which was the only stop for kids, for kids' cartoons. It really was the place to be. All of a sudden, the three networks, or the fourth network, once you added Fox in the mix,
sure.
were all of a sudden being overshadowed by a cable channel that didn't have the same amount of exposure as it. You know, you got to realize the cable only was seen in 2/3 of the country, and yet they were garnishing almost double the rating of what ABC was getting at the time.
Let's move on to DC then.
Sure.
I know you started writing Superboy with Jimmy Palmiotti. Was that? I know you had a Guardian pitch.
Yeah.
Which eventually became the Superboy title instead.
That's my cautionary tale in comics.
Was that Jim Harper, the Guardian?
Actually, no. We came up with a new Guardian character.
Okay.
What happened was that Jimmy was just breaking into writing. And Jimmy and I had known each other for a long time. We actually lived in the same building back in Brooklyn, where he still lives now, actually.
Okay.
And what happened was that we had, you know, Jimmy was trying to push a lot of things, and we were pitching things like 2099 stories over at Marvel. And he came over to D.C., and we pitched the Guardian idea, and it actually went through quite a long process. And then ultimately the project was rejected because, believe it, ironically, a similar theme story was going to be taking place in Superboy at the time.
Okay.
So they basically pushed our idea aside, and that was that. Then you flash forward about 3 years later. Jimmy's breaking out now as a writer. He's writing Deadpool, I think, was at the time. And the D.C. guys approach him. And they said, would you be interested in doing something here? And Jimmy, you know, not wanting to waste any good ideas, said, you know, well, I had a pitch in with a friend over there for the Guardian. So they said, sure, why don't you dust it off and send it back in. So we sent the Guardian pitch back in. They said, great, I love it. The only thing missing is a guest star. You know, you should have a guest star in it. We love everything about it, but let's put a guest star in it. Why don't you put Superboy as a guest star because there's a relationship between the Guardian and Superboy. And we go, great, that sounds great. And I get it. Jimmy calls me up. He tells me to make the change. He comes back. He says, listen, this is really good, but we want to see more of the guest star, so we have to raise the amount of it. Could you make it more about 50-50, the Guardian and Superboy? I said, sure. You make the change. We'll go ahead and do it. So then it comes back. He goes, this is great. But you know what? We're thinking of actually running this in the Superboy line. So instead of just making it about the 50-50 Guardian and Superboy, can you pull back on the Guardian stuff and just push more Superboy stuff to the forefront? Okay, sure. So we make the change again and we send it back in. Then the last one comes back. Listen, we love all your Superboy stuff. Can you just take the Guardian stuff out because it's not working for us? So Jimmy tells me that story, and I'm on the phone with him, and there's a pause. And I'm like, Jimmy, are we writing Superboy? And he goes to me, yeah, shh, quiet. Don't say a word. Just write. So we wound up fitting it, starting it. Then ultimately we were on it for what was going to be, you know, an unlimited run at the time. But what had happened was, you know, there was this, ironically, as the first issue of Superboy was coming out, I was interviewing for the job here at DC Comics. And it was just crazy serendipity. And what happened was that even more ironic was the fact that as I'm interviewing with Paul Levitz, he doesn't even know that I'm one of the co-writers on Superboy at the time. I have to tell him in the course of the interview. Which was, you could see that there was a strange look, there was a strange pause and look like, what's what? And I'm like, I really got to know what's more about what's going on in my books. So by the time the interview was done, you know, I had come in the doors. It was awkward for me to be writing and then also trying to learn about the area and things like that.
Okay.
Plus I felt that Superboy wasn't working at the time and the direction wasn't working and we didn't have a strong direction to go into. So ultimately we wound up canceling the series. So my first official act at DC Comics was to cancel the book that I was working on.
Well, and I appreciate the changes that you guys ultimately made in Superboy because I think, you know, maybe the string had run out in terms of the way the character was originally positioned post Reign of the Superman.
Right.
And then you guys found a new purpose for him, or one of the creators did. And I think that's really been a hallmark of your tenure, is finding new purpose in established characters and kind of breathing new life
in. What I wanted to do was, there's several stories here. The first one is that when I first walked in the door, you know, I would sit there, you know, and this is the one I always get the most complaints about in my story, but I have to tell it anyway, so we can renew all the complaints again. I looked at Supergirl that came out at the time. And we're looking at a comic called Supergirl, and I'm like, so tell me about Supergirl. And the answer comes back, she's a protoplasmic matrix from a pocket dimension that merged with some suicidal teenager that's now infused with the Angel of Vengeance and Fire, or something like that.
Yeah.
And I stopped and I said, what? And I said, yeah, that's Supergirl. And I said, what's that have to do with Superman and Supergirl? And the answer comes back to me and goes, absolutely nothing. Isn't that great? It has nothing to do with Superman and Supergirl at all. And I said, yeah, but everything we do about Supergirl is it's that Superman's cousin. And that was one of the first things we started to realize is that they got to a period of change in comics primarily in the from the 90s. There was so much product being put out and so much need for big events and changes and things going on there that so much was changed just for the sake of change.
Sure.
And as the expression goes, they threw the baby out with the bathwater.
Absolutely.
You know, they threw out, you forgot what the core concept was about. You forgot what the strength was about. You know, you go to Green Lantern or Hal Jordan. Hal Jordan's killed and everybody, the Green Lantern core is destroyed because they want to make Green Lantern unique. Green Lantern was never about being unique. Green Lantern was always about being a member of a force, a member of a police force. That's like saying any police drama can never work because there's too many cops, you know? So you have to make the characters good. So what it was about, everything we did, was let's scrape down every character to its core concept. Let's scrape down, and we sat in rooms, literally, and sat down and said, what do we like about these guys? Why do people care? Why do people care about Green Lantern? Why do people care about Superman? Why do people care about Supergirl? Why do people care about all these different characters? And what we came back with is that if there was enough strength at the core concept or the initial idea, then we would build around that a new sense of contemporary stories and a new contemporary idealism. If it didn't, then what we did is says, you know what, let's roll the dice. Let's try a new direction for this. Let's try something new. I mean, you know, there's a lot of discussion about Firestorm all the time, about why we came up with Jason Rush. Because what happened was, and what people forget, is the fact that Firestorm was about Ronnie Raymond and Martin Stein. And then
right.
It became about somebody else, you know, and they kept on evolving that character to the point that they got so far away from the core concept. And then when you started to look at the story, we looked at Martin Stein and started to realize, well, the old guy is the more interesting guy. He's the one whose life is constantly in flux. He's the one who comes up with all the fixes. He's the one whose life is in turmoil because he's being sucked into a matrix and has no control over it.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, you know, he's the one with all the problems that has to overcome. And Martin Stein was more interesting than Ronnie Raymond at how it was being developed. And we said, you know what? If we wanted to approach and have a younger take on this character, then we needed to go back to a new set. And since Ronnie was so tied to Martin, we wanted to go with a brand new direction, and that's how we came up with Jason.
That's fair. How would you compare that, though, to what you guys tried to do with Aquaman? And I'll say right off the bat, I've enjoyed what Kurt and Butch guys have done on the book, and I thought it was an interesting turn. And I also think, and I'd like this as a follow-up, I think there are certain Justice League members, despite their being so well-known, that just, I think it's tough to maintain a monthly book with a lot of these guys.
That's a huge question. The question is whether or not some characters are just meant to be supporting cast members.
Yeah.
You know, and some people might say Aquaman, and you could go to Marvel with Namor.
Absolutely.
Submariner. You know, these are two characters that have very similar themes to it, naturally, and neither one of them has been able to continuously support product for an extended period of time.
Yeah, great runs through the decades for both characters.
Great bits and pieces, great interesting things. I think, you know, when Peter David jumped on Aquaman when he first came on, the whole sensibility, great stuff there. A lot of fun, a lot of excitement. But it sort of wandered away. And even with us, when we came and we wanted to do the Sub Diego story,
yes,
a lot of fun and excitement when we first started, but it sort of meandered a little bit. And again, once we decided to change direction with Kurt, we really wanted to throw it out and get a fresh set of eyes. It was all about getting a fresh look, a fresh idealism, and so that you would be able to follow that story and go ahead. I mean, what happened was that with all the multiple incarnations of Aquaman through the years, we actually got away from the whole Arthur Curry concept, so we wanted to get back to it again.
Okay, but and I don't know what's coming up. And by the way, Dan, I'm one of those guys that actually likes reading the books and not finding out until the book is actually read.
Yeah, you might. My problem is that I actually find out. Unfortunately, I do find out when I actually read it what happens too. By the way.
Well, that's it seems like maybe things are shifting back to the Orin Aquaman, and I don't know. We'll see. I guess where the book lands with the new writer. But I'm also curious because it seems now, and I think to a degree of success, that a lot of concepts might start with your core go-to writers like Grant Morrison, Greg Rucka, Jeff Johns, and then sometimes are passed on to another writer. The Atom is a good example of that. Or not.
You know what? I'm always too honest sometimes. Here's my problem. What happens is that we say, you know what, we want to do something with Aquaman. Right? We know it.
Right.
So what happens is that you get a half dozen pitches.
Right.
That come in from different writers. And you look at them, and you know what? They're all various shades of gray. Do you know? One's a little bit better here, one's a little bit better there, one's a little bit better here, one's a little bit better there. So the problem is that, you know, you don't get exactly what you want, which you think might be the strongest product. I have a lot of faith. I mean, Grant Morrison in particular. is just an idea machine. He's just brilliant.
Sure. You know,
there's no way to describe it. He comes up with more ideas and more concepts than most people do, you know, in a career. He can come up with it over lunch. You know, and I mean, and honestly, he throws things out there and with such direction, clarity, and attitude that you believe it. The hard part sometimes is the execution.
Certainly.
Like, take those ideas and be able to execute them properly because it's so unique in the way he presents it. But what we're trying to do right now is go to the people who we think understands the direction of the universe the best so that we can hopefully launch out. And that's not to malign anyone else. It's just to say these are the guys who we're comfortable with in working with because we've have a long relationship. And they know the direction. They know the focus. They know the attitude. And that way we get a more, I don't want to say unified vision, but more consistency in what the vision of the world is.
Is there enough room, though, for creative freedom for a team to come in?
Absolutely.
And still also, because, and also, I can appreciate both ends of that as well. Tell your own story, but by the same token, big events are coming. You know, certain beats do have to be hit to figure into the bigger story as well.
Absolutely. Why didn't Marvel work so well? You know, in the early days, the stuff that was the reason why it was established with such a tight continuity, that's because Stan Lee ran gunshot on it.
Okay.
You know, for the first years, he wrote it all. For the next bunch of years, he edited it all. And the next bunch of years, a bunch of people were just responding to the way Stan had done it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you get other editor chiefs and other people coming in. How would Stan write this book? What would Stan do? And it's not until later on, until Jim Shooter comes along, that it starts to branch out a little bit, but it's still very clearly tied to those early origins. What's happened with DC Comics is that every time somebody new comes in, they look to put their stamp on it. They look to switch it. They look to flip it. And what we're trying to do is make sure that there's a uniformity, a direction, and a basis from which all the concepts have come from, so therefore we don't have that wildly divergent styles every time a new team comes on board. You know, you don't want to have a new exciting direction every six issues.
No, I agree with that, but I also think that you, in a good way, exploit the idea of events and just making specific arcs where, take for example, even right now what you're doing in Batman, Grant Morrison maybe falls behind. That's great. You guys plug in a big team like Ostrander and Mandrake to come in.
That's the goal. The goal is never to make it feel like consistency of product is very tough to maintain right now. And
sure.
I'm a very strong believer in the monthly book. That's what comics are. That's what unique is about it. We are periodical storytellers. And granted, we're having so much problems or we're having difficulties maintaining level of schedules with our best-selling books and some of the other books as well, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't shoot to be monthly storytellers. And in order to do that, we just have to be smarter and plan ahead. And to make sure that, you know, we know the days of dropping in a reprint book as a fill-in to fill in for a month are over.
Sure.
Nothing quite like picking up that issue of Iron Man where he's fighting Hulk and find out that it's a reprint from Iron Man number 10. You know?
I remember.
Okay, I figured you would. I love throwing out references and see who gets them. Anyway, but, you know, that worked then. What we need to do right now is be able to work out, and if we have a greater fiction going and we know our expectations on delivery from talent and the current teams, then what we can do is be able to build where we think we can drop in stories that matter at times when they matter most. And that's the goal of the line.
It seems like you do a mix, too, of having faith in a specific creative team and letting them go for years on a given book. Or it's interesting that in the case of, I think, once you established or reestablished with the Jim Lee runs on things like Batman and Superman, that you are able to kind of, with those characters, bring in creative teams for a six-month arc and then move on and give it to somebody else.
You know what that depends on? It depends on how iconic a character is.
Okay.
Because a Batman or a Superman is so iconic, and everybody's so clear about who they are and what their character motivations are and behaviors are, that you can move teams in and out much more frequently without upsetting the apple cart, so to speak.
Sure.
When you have a book like Birds of Prey, though, which has a very distinct voice and a distinct vision, and Gail Simone has really made that her own, it's very hard to extract her from the book without losing some of the personality from the book. And I think in some cases you can change teams without the character suffering. In some cases you might have to hold back a little bit to make sure that whatever balance you've achieved is maintained for the success of the series.
That's cool. I like the way that you guys have used 52, and really even before it, in some ways, Infinite Crisis, to reintroduce a bunch of characters that had been sitting unused for so many years. And I wonder...
Well, that's the fun part. I mean, there's two jobs here. There's two jobs. There's maintenance. Make sure that Superman, Batman, Justice League, and Teen Titans are the best they can be. That's maintenance.
Mm-hmm.
The other job is finding a way to make the other characters that sit on the skirt and the edge that are somebody's favorites but have never hit the radar in a big way, find a way to make them exciting and make them bigger than they are. That's the one that gets you juiced a lot more, because when you hit that, when you press that button and you find a way to make something that hasn't worked in the past worked, there's nothing more exciting than that. You see people reacting and getting excited about things they're not supposed to be.
Okay. In terms of 52, I just talked about this with Mark Waid. I know there are characters in 52 that will spin off into either new miniseries or on new ongoings, and I don't know which ones and don't really want to know specifically. But
you got any ideas? Because we're running out of time.
Well, are you able to measure fan reaction in a good way? Because there's sales, and obviously 52 is doing great. It's consistently selling well. But can you really get into the minutiae and say, wow, that little interlude with Super Chief really worked, but, you know, reintroducing the Atomic Knights in the Battle for Bloodhaven didn't? There's two that I could pull out of my ass for you.
Yeah, that was a fun one. everybody thought I lost my mind, including myself.
Yeah, which one, Super Chief or the Atomic Knights?
There's nothing quite like pitching Paul Levitz the Atomic Knights, let me tell you. He looked at me like, you're kidding, right?
I thought that was great, man.
And I said, trust me. And they become even bigger going ahead. That's even more fun about it. What's the best way to put that?
I've stumped you.
Yeah, you did. No, it's not. I'm just trying to phrase it properly.
No, that's cool, man.
Ask the question one more time.
Well, you know, is there a way of looking at 52 and finding these specific characters and saying, this one works, this one doesn't?
Because my answer is a non-answer. I've already done that. One of the spin-off books that was going to come out of 52 is no longer there. It's now something else because something broke bigger in the course of the run of the series.
Okay.
How about that?
All right. No, that's interesting. You know,
That's actually happened twice.
Oh, okay. That's cool. You know, and that's one of the things I love about when you do your panels at the DC Nation, because you're hilarious that way, and I like the way that you've just kind of cryptically answered things like that in the large group. And I give you credit for running what could be sometimes a pretty unruly crowd because of – it's so funny. I don't think people realize – I said this to Joe Quesada a few weeks ago, and I don't mean to keep name-dropping, but I always want to get your opinion and let people know what other – creators have said about this subject as well. I don't think some people who are so passionate about their characters realize how indestructible they are in terms of the ways you can mess with them. And if something doesn't work, you can always, you know, either go back and go with what's always worked or try something different.
1938, I've only been around since 1959. And guess what? When I'm gone, he's going to still be around.
You bet.
That's reality. You know what? And as soon as you understand that reality, you're going to realize whatever mark you make on him will make effect to someone. And something, hopefully, that you've done something. But at the end of the day, the character will prevail.
Sure.
You know what I mean? When I sit here and I get into arguments with people, I can identify when they started buying comics based upon what they're most passionate about. Because you could say, if somebody comes to me and goes, oh, I can't believe Wally West, and I go, ha, post-crisis, you know? You know? You know what
yes,
I mean?
They do.
And they go like this, and it's like, you know, so you're able to build that relationship with everybody based upon what they love. You could figure it out.
Well, and conversely, now I'm not going to hammer you about Nightwing because I think you've explained yourself. What I want to know though is, I mean, no, and that's, you know, that's fair because I think you were very fair in saying it's a redundant character if there already is somebody else as Robin.
Absolutely.
What was there one specific argument, or was it the chorus of everyone explaining to you why Dick Grayson was important? What was it that made you say, okay?
It's a chorus.
Okay.
Jeff Johns leading the chorus. Paul Levitz, of course, naturally part of the chorus.
Sure.
which is the biggest voice of them all.
You bet.
And I didn't push it because we had a better solution.
Okay.
Okay. I think we had I shouldn't say better solution, but a solution of equal value that I thought brought the same impact. I think that, and the most interesting thing that came out of it all is the concept of discussion about Nightwing. We, DC Comics, took Nightwing for granted. We take Nightwing for granted. That's what happens. So if anything, it creates that discussion that allows you to examine whether or not the character has more potential or not. So the question is, okay, so everybody's yelling at me. Why are you yelling? What are you upset about? Why do you love Nightwing so much? You know? And if it's because I read one issue of him 20 years ago, that's not an answer. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
But if it's because this is the strength of the character, this is who he represents, this is why he's different from Batman, this is the reason why he's different from Tim Drake, this is why he's going to be playing against Jason Todd, and this is his role, and you remove him from that role, everything comes apart. Then you got something interesting. So you say, okay, now if I pull Nightwing out, well, everything comes apart. what happens if I leave him in with the knowledge that everything would have came apart if he came out?
Sure. No, and I think that's
and that's the story.
Yeah, and that's what I look forward to, and obviously you've teased that, I think, in the books, that, yeah, let's see what does happen now that there is this kind of paradox of, no, he was supposed to die.
Yeah.
And that's way to go to turn a negative into a positive. I think that's great.
And that's what it was. And then what happened is that we examined other characters of similar veins, and then something started to come alive, which will be playing out through all of 2007.
Very cool. Are there other generational characters that that you guys have identified that older members of the audience can say, hey, that's my character? Like I always thought, especially during Crisis, that two guys that I was worried about dying were Alan Scott and Jay Garrick, because I just figured, well, they're the Golden Age. They've had their day in the sun. I can appreciate their standing as a mentor character, but I can also see it being, hey, these are old men. I don't know how many useful stories we have.
That's one of the reasons why we found new ways to play them. Alan Scott moved into a mentor role in Checkmate book.
You bet.
And from there, Jay Garrick moved into a role of mentor to Bart Allen and a character for Bart to play again.
Sure.
So in both cases, see, it's weird because I don't see the redundancies. This is where you get tattooed. I don't see the redundancies in Jay Garrick and Alan Scott. Because, again, they serve a purpose. They're a benchmark to what has come before. They're a voice from the past. They're their grandparents sitting in the room. And the fact
absolutely.
That they have generational ties throughout the DC Universe is important.
Sure.
That's what's exciting to me. The difference between Alan Scott and Dick Grayson is Alan Scott's got two children. He's got a history with the team. He's got a long past, and people turn to him for advice. People do that with Dick, but reality is that a lot of questions being asked, Dick, could go to somebody else, or maybe not, and that's the reason why he survives.
I got you. When you first started as executive editor, you threw a lot of things against the wall that were non-superhero, and I liked a lot of them.
Yeah.
And Judd Winnick's mob story, and right
Paper.
Now, thank you very much. It was great. Is there room for those kind of books still in the DCU?
I would hope so, but. I tried. You're right. As I always like to say, Hush covered up so many mistakes. I can't tell you. And Hush covered up so many other attempts at product. Remember the Focus books?
Yes, and I wanted to ask about that because I hope you don't consider those mistakes.
Far from it.
Good.
But the way we presented them and my problem is the expectation level when you put the DC logo on the book. There's an expectation of product.
Sure.
And the bottom line is that for me. And the hardest thing for me to let go was the fact that I liked doing those things, but I also understood that that's what Vertigo's role is and that's what Wildstorm's role is. There's a lot more experimentation going on there in great ways. And one of my roles is to push the superhero line. And one of the things that I'm going to try to do is find ways to show variations of superhero themes. That's what Focus was about. It was trying to take the core conceit of what a superhero comic is and turn it around so that you could see the dotted line between Focus and the DC Universe. You couldn't see a line between Caper and the DCU. So it's harder for me to do a Caper-style book because a Caper could easily land on a Vertigo's desk or it's on a Wildstorm desk. But from my standpoint, I have to look at, say, what makes sense from extending out from the DC Universe. Jonah Hex made sense.
Sure.
Even though he's not in costume, he is in costume. Even though he's not a superhero, he is a superhero. That's why Jonah makes sense, and we're going to continue to push that. That's one of the reasons why we kept a big push on trying to go with science fiction and a big push trying to go with horror and mystery, big push trying to even expand on the Western line. We're going to bring back Batlash because the reason why is that you don't want to be just doing one flavor, but what I've got to do is be able to give variations of flavor that our core audience accepts.
Is there a team set for Batlash?
We're actually all set now. We've got you got to forgive me, but Sergio is back involved in the book. We got John Severin on the art.
Oh, that's great.
And I'm sorry, the writer's name escapes me, but we've actually brought in a very accomplished Western writer novelist to come on board and work with John to pull the book together.
Wow. And what will Sergio is Sergio Aragonis's role?
Yeah,
in the book?
He's Sergio created the characters. We wanted him back involved, so he's actually giving a lot of insight on how the character works. And I think he's co-writing the book as I'm speaking. If I'm understanding you correctly.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
And God, John, every time someone brings up John Severin, I always have to point out he's like one of the best guys from the Golden Age that like. I think falls under the radar when you talk about some of the great guys from the 40s, 50s, and on.
Right.
So that's great. He's a brilliant Western artist. So that's
It's just wonderful. You'd be surprised how many people can't draw horses anymore.
Tell me about are we cool for a couple more minutes?
Yeah, we've got 5 more minutes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Tell me about the year one books that you've got coming up. Green Arrow, Metamorpho, Teen
Titans,
year one.
Yeah, the whole purpose of year ones is that we have a couple of characters that have been spun on their ears a little bit. It was funny. Metamorpho is a perfect example. When I first started here, there was a month, ironically, where Metamorpho appeared in 3 or 4 books the same exact month, which is wonderful for Metamorpho, but what was disappointing for me is that there was a lack of consistency in the representation of the character. He acted one way in one book. He acted like the remote in Freedon Metamorpho in one book. He looked like the Outsiders Metamorpho here. He acted like the Justice League Metamorpho there. And everybody took their interpretation or their favorite interpretation and inserted that into the character. And we sit in a room and go, what's the right direction? Because ultimately it's hard to pinpoint the clear line for certain characters who are popular but have been just used randomly throughout the line over years. So what I'm trying to do is find a way to unify the themes, unify the thoughts behind the character, give them a better base to work from. So therefore, when we say, here, you want to use Metamorpho, this is what he's about. And more importantly, when people read the miniseries, they go, okay, that's the Metamorpho I like, and that's the one I'm going to go looking for.
Okay.
And, you know, and that happened to me with Metamorpho, and that actually happened. We actually had a month where Black Lightning appeared in 4 books, and he wore 3 different costumes in the same month.
Well, that's cosmetic, but I it's funny. Now, I think in terms of Black Lightning, there was a pretty – Tony Isabella had a very strong, very very straight line in terms of you know, what his character was. Wouldn't that be solved as well – and taking nothing away from Jen Van Meter, who I'm a huge fan of, but wouldn't it be served as well by just coming out with a showcase featuring all those stories from the 70s?
We won't.
Okay.
But, I mean, what's happened on this is that you got to remember what we've also done since Tony's run on the book. And believe me, I have every single issue of that as well.
At a point.
You know?
That's cool.
You know, from Tobias Whale on out.
You bet. No, that's a great character. Absolutely.
You know? And one of the things that it's deadly cyanide. Is cyanide in that stuff? I don't know. Anyway, this is when the brain starts working in bad ways.
Where's your cyanide?
What,
in something you're eating there, cyanide?
No, it wasn't cyanide. Wasn't the villains in Black Lightning?
Oh, you know something? I just remember Tobias Whale and really just – I really remember those first, like, 10 or 20 issues mostly.
Yeah, and then they had that second run of the book, too, which was real solid.
Okay.
They had some backup work that was done. If I'm not mistaken, Denny O'Neill did backups in Detective and a couple other places with Black Lightning. And then we had Black Lightning as the secretary of – you know,
yes, under Luther. Yeah,
under Luther over there, and we've got a new daughter retconned into his history.
Yes,
and to be perfectly honest, I think he's a usually viable character. That's one of the reasons why, and we've had some success. We've had actually some success. We've had a lot of success with Outsiders, and we're trying to rebuild that team. Black Lightning is now coming to the forefront in Justice League of America. It seemed like the right time just to place him out there again. With a first year origin, just to set the rules, especially with the success of we're seeing with the character in Justice League.
Very cool. Last question.
Sure.
War books. I thought Garth Ennis's series was just exceptional. And was that a Vertigo series? I think it was a Vertigo series.
Actually, no. It was over at Wildstorm.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
War stories. Well, I really loved the showcases lately. Showing how great those books were, and especially during the Silver Age. I think there was really good writing going on.
Yep.
I think that people don't look back and realize, because it's so easy to dismiss those books as being written for kids. And there's great art and great writing, and it was so great to see the Unknown Soldier collection.
I'll tell you right now, if you're enjoying things, look at what people have forgotten and lost art, is what you're reading in the showcases and things like that, which is the ability to tell a story in 8 to 11 pages.
Exactly.
You know, take a look at that. It's very hard to get people to write like that these days. And it's an amazing craft, and it's unfortunate that we don't have outlets for talent to be able to tell stories in that format, because I think it's an incredible tool, because if you have strength in being able to tell a story that gets people involved in 11 pages, imagine how well you can tell a story when you open up the story some more. So,
you know, Jimmy and Justin are doing a good job telling Dunn and One stories in Jonah Hex.
Exactly.
Are you trying to find more teams that can do that?
Yeah, we are. I think that's some of the things we're going to look for. Granted, because like I said, a lot of things that we're building towards are going to have the ability that we're going to need certain things to be told or stated in a single story, but add to the overall theme. I mean, that's what a lot of people say. It's like, oh, you never ended Infinite Crisis. It keeps on going. I said, well, you know what? After Infinite Crisis ends, we still got to put another 55 books out next month. I'd love to tell you something otherwise, but it's not true. I've got to put out these books every month. So I'm going to need story, and I'm going to build on what works and what's successful and what people are reacting to, you know? You know, what's interests me is that the fact that I still have people upset about Identity Crisis and the scene with Sue Dibney.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting to me about that, that's 4 years ago. And they're still angry. So that means it's a really good story.
Well, you know, and I appreciate you bringing that up and saying that, because I agree with you. And I think plot devices are nothing new, and they've been going on for decades. And I think people read into them a lot more than they should, and should step back every now and then and remember that this is fiction.
Yep.
And I would say entertaining fiction as well. And I congratulate you on some very interesting, strong stories that at least evoke a strong reaction. And I guess at the end of the day, that means they're reading the books, and that's good news.
I feel the two things I'm most proud of are the fact that it elicits such a strong reaction, and I think we told the story as best it can be told. And I think that's the thing that we're most proud of, is the fact that we told a story that was so strong, that it got such a strong response, and I think we told it in a responsible and intelligent manner. And that's what we're proud of. I can't tell you how much I hold Identity Crisis as something that I feel is such an important moment for DC Comics.
And ramifications are still being played out.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I always joke about, you know, Spider-Man. You know, Spider-Man is my favorite character. Surprise, surprise. Spider-Man, my favorite. You know what I loved about Spider-Man?
No.
Which if we did today, everybody would go crazy about. The whole bit of Norman Osborn. That after Spider-Man beats Norman Osborn, first we go through Green Goblin, where we don't know who he is.
Right.
Then it's revealed to be his roommate's father. Ta-da. And then the roommate's father loses his memory. Convenient. After revealing his secret identity. And then every time we see the father, there's that glimmer, like, I'm going to remember. There's that thing, like, something about Peter Parker doesn't sit right. And there's something so great about how that played out. And you've got to realize that that story played out for 110 issues.
Wow, yeah.
And if you look at the Green Goblin story, it's one continuous story over 110 issues, from the moment that we first meet Green Goblin to the moment he gets killed.
No, that's a good point. That's a very good point. No,
and then the story continues then to the sun. So if people are looking for neat endings, you know, that's not what we do. We do periodicals.
Sure, sure. And really, I think Elongated Man has become a very tragic character, which is, you know, someplace where he needed to go, because he's always been such a light character, and Sue is the center of his universe. So I think if you are going to upset an apple cart, that's where you go.
I mean, you know, we also get into a very interesting discussion on Shazam. Last topic.
Okay.
You know, we have Trials of Shazam going, which I feel is continuing the story of Shazam. We're using Freddie Freeman, which I think is truthful. We're using Freddie Freeman as tied into the storyline.
Yes.
We're building upon everything that existed before, all the lore. We're building it out of continuity that came out from the miniseries into Infinite Crisis. So I feel that it's very beholden to the direction of what we want with the characters today. A lot of people are looking for that light C.C. Beck look, but unfortunately, it didn't sell in the 70s, it didn't sell in the 80s, it didn't sell in the 90s, and we have no reason to believe it'll sell today, although we are trying something as close to that as possible with the Jeff Smith. So fingers crossed, Jeff Smith stuff can really break big, but that's on the strength of that creator as well. Jeff Smith is an incredibly powerful and talented person, and I think that he will drive attention to that product just as much as Shazam will.
Last quick question, is there another humor creator that might be able to bring that lightness? I mean, you know, depending on how well...
Because I don't know if that lightness ever worked.
Okay.
But it works for a moment. It works for a snapshot. It doesn't work for on a continuous basis.
I hear you.
Yeah. I mean, even when we go back to the Justice League stuff for the, you know, I figure I might as well bring up everything that, you know, people can rant about. but we go back to the Giffen stuff. My problem was never with what Giffen and DeMatteis and McGuire did when the series first launched. That stuff is incredibly strong. It has humor, but it's all character humor. The people that followed and the way it was built on, and not only that, but how it expanded out through the line, turned it into comedic characters. Dr. Fate turns comedic.
Sure.
You know, Mr. Miracle turned comedic, and these are not comedic characters. You know, they were starting to look like buffoons.
Okay. Well, no, that's fair. I just think it just outlived its usefulness when it became three books, you know, the quarterly and the two monthlies as well. And it's any joke, when it's told 10,000 times, gets a little old after a while.
Exactly. And so what happens is, unfortunately, you have to scrub it all clean and then start fresh again. And that's what ultimately what Morrison's books did. And, you know, biggest change from the Giffen to Matter stuff is not when we kill the characters, but actually when the Justice League was launched with the Big Seven, the idea of the Big Seven, that everybody else in there wasn't worthy to be in the team. We only want the Big Seven.
I appreciate your time. I thought this was a great conversation. I hope we could do it again in the future.
That sounds great. I appreciate it as well.
That's Dan DiDio, the executive editor of DC Comics. And that'll do it for this edition of Word Balloon. Thanks a lot for listening. This is John Suntress. Don't forget, wordballoon.com can be found at iTunes, Podcast Alley, Podcast Pickle, wherever you find podcasts if you just do a search. We also have our MySpace page, myspace.com/wordballoon. We're at the Comic Space new community as well, comicspace.com/wordballoon. And, of course, our regular website, wordballoon.com. If you come to the website, be sure to fill out our listener survey. We'd love to know what you like and dislike about the show. And, of course, I'm always available for your questions and comments, john@wordballoon.com. Send me an email over there. I'll be happy to answer it for you. Until next time, Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2006.